The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. An exciting weekend here at Ed Stone with the December 7th festivities. We had quite a group for the service on Saturday. 103, I think, we had cramped into the downstairs room here at Ed Stone. And then that night, lots of fun and festivities. We had a potluck and a dance, including couple of our Irish dancers here who are here to put on this display. Nice audio rhythms there if you're listening to the audio, and you can see the two lads on the video stream as well. So an enjoyable evening. It actually continued on into yesterday as well. We had our winter recital for some of the music students, the singers, and also those playing instruments. And so that was yesterday afternoon. Quite a few of the brethren from down south coming up from London were able to stay overnight, and also to stay on for the recital yesterday afternoon. So we'll talk more about the anniversaries, that, and I say it plural because, of course, December 7th was when the Philadelphia Church of God started. 2 days after that, it was the Sabbath, although that wasn't the first official Sabbath service for the fledgling PCG. It happened the week after that, December 16th. But I was home at the time, December 9th, which was a Sabbath, or the Sabbath, back in 1989. And then my father, who had taken, I guess, a 2 or 3 day trip home from Pasadena, he drove my sister's truck to back to Edmond, and he arrived in Edmond on December 10th. So we'll talk, as I say, a little bit more about some of these anniversaries from 30 years ago later on today's show. Speaking of December 7th, by the way, President Trump, he gave a speech at the Israeli-American Council National Summit. That was on Saturday, and we've got some clips from that speech that we'll play for you a little bit later in this segment as well. Well, what a big week this is going to be with respect to news. With all that's scheduled to unfold, we could have some breaking news on this very program. We'll have to wait and see. Today, of course, is the day that the FISA report is supposed to be released. So we'll find out a lot more about some of the investigations that were going on even before Donald Trump came into office in January of 2017. That report expected to be released today. And then, of course, the impeachment hearings there in the House Judiciary. That continues today. Some interesting timing there. I think the Democrats hoping for a distraction, hoping that there's not too much news coverage given to the FISA report that's going to be released. But we'll see. We'll see how the major media cover it. We'll see how some of our favorite blogs and news sites cover the Horowitz report later today. And then, of course, he's scheduled to testify on Wednesday, so that's coming up this week as well. And then, of course, you have members of the House Judiciary that are saying they could even vote on the articles of impeachment this week. That was, I think, Gerald Nadler said that yesterday on one of the Sunday shows. And then, speaking of this week, you've got the UK elections. That's on Thursday. The Wall Street Journal, it says here, Britain gears up for its most divisive election in decades. That's a reoccurring theme, isn't it? With respect to Ephraim, Manasseh, and Little Judah. The most divisive, the most contentious decade in, or rather election in decades. It says the bitterly fought election campaign bookends more than 3 years of political stalemate over how or even if the UK should quit the European Union. 3 years of a stalemate. What they've experienced all through this year in Judah, the little Israeli state, that's pretty much a stalemate. It has been for a year. The Journal says here, if Mr. Johnson fails to gain a majority, a combination of opposition parties likely led by the Labour Party could come to power and call for another referendum on Brexit, further extending the uncertainty of Britain's split with its biggest trade partner. So we're in a period of uncertainty. There's a temporary resurgence. We'll look at that a little bit later with respect to, particularly with respect to America and its alliance with Judah or the little Israeli state. But what a period of uncertainty we're in. You look at the UK, you look at this election. They had the final debate, by the way, on Friday night. And Richard went through some of the contents from that, and he felt like there wasn't a whole lot new to come out of that that debate. He felt like the moderator at least did a better job of trying to keep himself out of the back and forth, allowing for more topics to be covered and such. Here's just a little snippet. The Telegraph here in the UK put this together, this video. Some highlights or lowlights, depending on how you look at it, from Friday night's debate, clip 10.
I do find it slightly curious, to say the least, Nick, to be lectured about the union between Great Britain and Northern Ireland by a man who all his life, political life, has campaigned to break up that union and actually supported for four decades the IRA in their campaign violently to destroy it. I must say I find it a curiosity.
There has to be a solution to it, but...
What's your solution?
Well, I've made that quite clear, actually. I'm not sure if you've been... But the point is...
We've been going for 40 minutes, and I don't know
what it is. About the cohesion of...
What is
our,
it?
The point is about the cohesion of our society. But there are problems of Islamophobia within our society also, as you quite rightly draw attention to, and there are problems of language that is used. I do not ever use racist language in any form to describe anybody in this world or in our society.
Let's be clear, you're saying that
we need a world where we treat people with respect.
But I think that in his handling of this particular issue, his unwillingness to take a stand, to stand up for Jewish people in the Labour Party, his unwillingness to protect them, to put an arm around them, is, it, in my view, a failure of leadership. You cannot be neutral on questions like this any more, in my view, than you can try to lead this country and be neutral on the issue of Brexit. After 55 Gentlemen. Minutes, we still do not know what Mr. Corbyn's deal would be.
That's a collection from The Telegraph, I think, at least from what we included there. Maybe some of the better moments for the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, as he hit Corbyn pretty hard on the anti-Semitism. And then, of course, his lack of a position on Brexit. We've talked before, going back to the anti-Semitism point, we've talked before about Jewish groups. One of the lead rabbis here in the UK, who's come out denouncing Corbyn, saying how if he were to win a majority, what a frightening scenario that would be for Jews living in Britain. And we'll talk more about anti-Semitism in Europe a little bit later on in this segment as well. But with respect to the anti-Semitic tendencies that are there with the Labour Party here in the UK, this is from the Times of Israel. From a few days ago, it says the leaked files from the main UK opposition party's internal disciplinary department show that many Labour members, several of whom had called for the extermination of all Jews, remained in the party for months and even over a year, and were given a lenient punishment, or none at all, according to the Sunday Times. So we didn't play it. I wasn't on the air that week, but that coming into the Thanksgiving holiday, Jeremy Corbyn sat down with Andrew Neil, and Andrew Neil really pressed his feet to the fire on this anti-Semitism within the Labour Party and just how party members, as the Times of Israel brings out there, based upon the Sunday Times report, they haven't done anything to punish those in their own party that have even gone so far as to call for the extermination of the Jews. That's pretty amazing. 2019, and he's still getting hit on this, as you heard from those clips. And yet, just like within the United States, that radical left-wing party has the full support from the major media, from popular culture, from celebrities, top to bottom. I mean, just the enthusiastic support. One celebrity here in the UK, Hugh Grant, the actor, he told us just how dreadful it would be if Boris Johnson gets through this election on Thursday, winning a majority. Here's what the actor had to say, clip 12.
I think that the country's on the edge of a true abyss, and that if Boris Johnson gets a majority, we will leave the EU with a no deal at the end of next year, because he won't have time to make a new free trade deal in that year. Hundreds of thousands of job losses, food shortages, medicine shortages, end of peace in Northern Ireland, massive blow to our standing, our influence in the world, etc., etc., etc. And I think that I need to do whatever modest thing I can to try and stop that.
Whatever modest thing he can do to try to stop it. So he tweets out his videos, and I'm sure there's tens of thousands, millions probably, of ordinary British citizens who are collectively just rolling their eyes at yet another celebrity who says that it's going to be the end of the world if a conservative is voted in or a Republican is voted in. It sounds like a broken record. You rarely hear from a celebrity that takes the different view or an opposing view to what's just universally believed and accepted in the entertainment industry. Well, speaking of, again, the news of this week, that FISA report coming out today, the Inspector General, it's long into, I mean, we've been hearing it's just about to be released, I think going back to April or May of this year. And this report is supposed to detail the FBI's decision to open up the Trump-Russia investigation going back to 2016 or even before that. But I'm sure that'll keep Sam busy this next week as we try to plow through some of that material, and maybe we'll have more to say on that tomorrow. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of good commentary as well. But then the Horowitz testimony that comes up on Wednesday. And then, as I say, you have all of these impeachment hearings revving up again. The Democrats surely looking for ways to take away from the attention that the Horowitz report will surely have. This is a short piece by Andrew McCarthy on the impeachment proceedings that we've seen in recent weeks. He says, even if you were already convinced that impeachment is a political stunt, you may not have been psychologically prepared for 8 hours of the Living Constitution crowd doing their best Justice Scalia impressions in explaining what James Madison would have made of Donald Trump. I made this point last week. Here you have all of these Democrats who are suddenly they're strict constitutionalists. They're citing James Madison. They're pointing to the Founding Fathers, the very ones they've been denigrating and trashing now for years. They go from pulling down their statues to now saying, look, we've just got to do this like James Madison would do it. McCarthy says, I couldn't help but wonder what James Madison would have made of giving $391 million to Ukraine. It's a good point. If you want to refer back to the Founding Fathers, well, let's see what they had to say about quite a few other things. McCarthy says before Trump began his term, before he even had a chance to commit any impeachable offenses, Democrats such as Professor Feldman, that was one of the ones who testified, remember last week, the program, the scholars. These were the left-wing scholars that they brought out, and those scholars had concluded that he needed to be impeached even before he was inaugurated. Or at least that was the position of Professor Feldman. His mind was made up before Mr. Trump even had a chance to commit an impeachable offense. McCarthy says, indeed, by January 20th, 2017, the Obama administration had already obtained its second surveillance warrant from the FISA court. It had already reapplied for the FISA warrant even before President Trump was inaugurated. And as I say, we'll learn more about that in today's report. If this is voted on this week, or I think the aim is to at least get it in before the winter holidays coming up at the end of this month, then it will move over to the Senate. And Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, he was on the shows yesterday talking about how that he was looking to, at least if he has any say over it, he's going to try to expedite this and move it through the Senate just as quickly as possible. Here's what Senator Graham had to say yesterday, clip two.
Well, the whole process is illegitimate in the House. It's not just a whistleblower. You don't want to create a situation where an anonymous person can start impeachment proceedings against the President of the United States. You can't get a parking ticket based on an anonymous allegation. The hearings were held behind closed doors. The Intel Committee gathered all the facts. The President's lawyer was never allowed to participate. They asked to call witnesses in the Judiciary Committee. They had one hearing in the committee with four law professors, and Nancy Pelosi said, we're going to move forward with the articles of impeachment. This is a joke of a process. It's dangerous to the country. It's the first impeachment scenario in the country started in-house, not with outside counsel. Whitewater prosecutor Ken Starr. You had Mueller looking at all things Russia and Trump. You had prosecutors in the Nixon case outside the system. This is being driven by Schiff and Nadler, Pelosi, partisan people. I think it's going to meet a quick end in the Senate.
He predicts a quick end. Of course, it has to get two-thirds of the Senate for a conviction to happen, but he was talking yesterday about if they just get 51 senators that say, look, we've heard enough, they're going to put a pretty quick end to it. Here he is again talking about how it's going to move through the Senate quickly, clip four, or three, sorry.
That I'm going to end this as quickly as I can for the good of the country. When 51 of us say we've heard enough, the trial is going to end. The president's going to be acquitted. He may want to call Schiff, he may want to call Hunter Biden, he may want to call Joe Biden, but here's my advice to the president. If the Senate is ready to vote and ready to acquit you, you should celebrate that, and we can look at this other stuff outside of impeachment. Impeachment is tearing the country apart. I don't want to give it any more credibility than it deserves.
He's responding there in part to the president's administration saying, look, if this goes to trial, fine, we're going to drag it out and we're going to expose, which would be interesting. Graham's take is that you should get out of it as quickly as you can because it's destroying the country. It's dividing the country. So it'll be interesting to watch in these upcoming weeks. As I said, the House, Nadler and the others, they're already talking about a potential vote, maybe even this week, as far as the House is concerned. And I thought this exchange yesterday was revealing as well. This is NBC's Chuck Todd asking about if he's not convicted in the Senate, well, what does this mean for next year's election, the presidential re-election next November? Listen to this, clip four.
Let me ask you this. If he's acquitted, do you believe we'll have a fair election in 2020?
I don't know. The president, based on his past performance, will do everything he can to make it not a fair election. And that is part of what gives us the urgency to proceed with this impeachment.
Remember, with so much of this, it's the media who are driving it, this radical left-wing ideology, agenda, or narrative. That's NBC asking, if he's acquitted, So if the Senate doesn't convict, are we going to even have a fair election? Because, well, you know what he's saying there. It wasn't fair in 2016. He cheated in 2016, even though he didn't have any power. He wasn't in office. Barack Obama was in office. And Barack Obama, all the way up to the election, was saying, Russia, who cares? No worries there. They're not going to meddle. They certainly can't do it on a grand scale. And then as soon as Donald Trump's voted in, oh, no, it was a grand scale. He cheated. He helped Donald Trump. And then, of course, if you believe the rotten dossier, well, Donald Trump actually colluded with Putin. And they're still hanging on to that, as I noted last week. They can't let it go. So if he is acquitted, are we going to have a fair election next year? And Nadler says there, well, I mean, judging by his past performance, probably not. He's probably going to cheat his way in. They won't let it go. They know it's coming, but they can't let it go. The only way that he could possibly get in is if he cheats. That's the only way it could have happened in 2016. And they're already preparing themselves for the next go-round. The attacks will never stop. There was a congressman last week who said that we may just have to continue impeaching him from here on out. If at all it takes is a 30-minute phone call with the President of the United States where there was no quid pro quo, Ukraine got the money, they got the javelins, they got the meeting with the president. They got everything. And then there was no investigation into the Bidens on top of that. And yet they're building the impeachment case. They're somehow making it out to be bribery when the president, he never took any money from Ukraine. It was just the opposite. He gave them $391 million. And if we want to be true to the founding fathers, like McCarthy brings out, what would James Madison think of handing a half billion dollars to Ukraine, of all places? Well, the president did it. He did it to help Ukraine in its opposition to Russia. Well, there's a piece here at the New York Post about some of the surveillance tactics of Adam Schiff and his staff, and we commented on that at length on last week's program, or the programs last week. The point that it makes here is that all these years of Democrats sounding the alarm about how dangerous it is for NSA or whatever organization to snoop or to spy on Americans. How that if we don't stop this now, it's eventually they're going to start spying on political opponents. That's exactly what they're doing. That's exactly what Schiff's people are doing. That was then, the article says. Today, Adam Schiff not only employs the power of the surveillance state to smear his colleagues and press his political agenda, he set a number of dangerous precedents by unmasking his political rivals in an effort to smear them with innuendo. You would think Chuck Todd would be concerned about this. You would think he'd ask Nadler about this, these tactics. But no, he's already asking about next year's election. Will it be fair? Can we be sure it will be fair next year? After all, he's cheated before. And they've already established the narrative for next year because they know they don't have enough to kick him out of office. All they have enough for is to slap him on the wrist. And as so many commentators have noted, the voters are paying attention, and they don't like it. They don't like how this president is being treated. When we come back, I guess we can break this up into a separate segment, but we'll go through this speech that the president gave on Saturday at the Israeli-American Council National Summit, an excellent speech about U.S. Israeli relations. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
President Trump was in Florida on Saturday night delivering a speech to the Israeli-American Council National Summit, and in this speech, he talked at length about the relationship between the United States and Israel and just how different it is today than it was under the previous administration. This is clip five.
Now it's truly my honor to be here this evening to celebrate our progress to deepen the incredible partnership between the United States and Israel, and it suffered very gravely in the last administration. I don't know if you know that. So many of you voted for people in the last administration. Someday you'll have to explain that to me, because I don't think they liked Israel too much. I'm sorry. I don't think they liked Israel too much. After 8 long years in which our alliance was undermined and neglected, I am happy to report that the United States-Israeli relationship is stronger now than ever before.
Lots of applause lines in the speech, and a direct hit on the Obama administration. And just the attack, not just on America, as my father wrote, but the attack on Israel, how that relationship, it was the Obama administration that was actually undermining it, neglecting it, insulting Netanyahu. But how different it's been in the last 3 years. He talked about how that the Jewish state has never had a better friend than it has right now in the White House. That's quite a statement. There was a, in response to this speech over in Israel, you look at some of the Israeli press, the way they covered it. There's one at Israel Hayom. This is a conservative publication. But the author there, he can't even believe just how Israel's receiving such favorable treatment from a U.S. president. And he's upset because Israel's bitterly divided right now and unable in some ways to climb aboard this Trump tide. It says here, after 8 years of dealing with the Obama administration, it's a little hard to get used to all the benefits the Trump administration affords Israel. It's a pity, he says, that such a sympathetic administration with which to work, Israel can't seem to muster up a stable government. You can see why Netanyahu's haters are attacking him viciously, because they know what's happening here. They look at what's happened in Washington, and they don't want any part of it. These are Israel haters, haters from within, and they don't want to see that alliance strengthening. He says the show of solidarity afforded to the state of Israel at the American Council National Summit in Florida on Saturday was one of the most impressive ever. I guess there were 4,200 people on hand. But he says here, but something clouded the event. I have had the opportunity to talk to President Trump on numerous occasions, including at the conference, and I've been repeatedly reminded of the fact that he's the most pro-Israel president we've ever dealt with. The most pro-Israel president ever. Says, but Israel, instead of making the most out of this tremendous friendship and promoting issues imperative to Israel, is crippled by a political logjam and mired in mudslinging, leaks, accusations, and political courting, all while our best friend is struggling to understand what is happening with its stable partner in the Middle East. The Trump people, they can't understand this. Get your act together. Let's work together. The Jerusalem Post, which has really swung to the left in recent years, they were doing everything that they could to try to find some negatives in Mr. Trump's speech on Saturday night. But even the JP had to concede that, you know, this is pretty special. This is pretty amazing. It says here, the bulk of Trump's speech warmed the audience's hearts, and rightly so. He has stood by Israel over the last 3 years in a starkly different way than the previous administration. Even the Jerusalem Post acknowledges this. This is much different than it was before 2017. You think about the shot that the Obama administration took at Israel, even in the last part of December of 2016, on the way out, they punched Israel in the nose. They just wanted to stick it to Israel every opportunity that they could. Here's a little more from Saturday night, clip 6.
My administration is also confronting the world's number one state of terror. You know who that is. Your state sponsor of terror, the brutal dictatorship in Iran. And I said to Sheldon, what do you think was bigger? Israel, and if you look, what was the bigger thing? Israel and the embassy going in, and it became Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, or the Golan Heights? He said, neither. I said, what do you mean, neither, Sheldon? He said, the biggest thing you did for Israel was breaking up and terminating the horrible, one-sided, catastrophic deal that was made by President Obama.
Right? He took the Iran nuke deal, ripped that to shreds, decided right away, let's move the embassy to Jerusalem. And we'll talk more about the embassy here in just a second. But then also acknowledging or identifying the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. And there he is, identifying this evil regime in Iran. Quite a different position than the previous administration, which was constantly courting Iran and its diplomats to try to solidify that disastrous deal. The president, for his part, on Saturday night said any regime that chants death to America or death to Israel, they can't get a nuclear weapon. They're not a partner in peace. That's what he said, or words to that effect, on Saturday night. And then he talked further about the position, the radical leftist positions, even within our own nations. This is clip 7.
Make no mistake, radical lawmakers who support the BDS movement are advancing anti-Israel and anti-Semitic propaganda, and Americans will not stand for it. We're not going to stand for it. We've also seen far-left members of Congress proliferate dangerous anti-Semitic rhetoric. You've seen it. It's rhetorically and morally unacceptable. One lawmaker even wrote that Israel has hypnotized the world and said support for Israel is all about the Benjamins. You heard that? And I'll be honest, that's one of the nicer statements. Far worse. She said far worse than that. And so did others in Congress.
In the U.S. Congress. He's referring to AOC, of course. But there's others spewing out Jew hatred. You know, it's interesting. They had a gathering in Berlin on the same day, December 7th. This group called the Palestinian Return Center. And they had all these representatives with these close ties to Hamas. And they're having a gathering, a meeting in Berlin on the same day that President Trump spoke there in Florida in front of that Jewish group regarding the meeting in Berlin. The U.S. ambassador to Germany, he tweeted out that we've raised our concerns over this. Hamas is a terrorist organization and should not be welcomed in Berlin, but they are. Berlin, of course, is run by the left wing, the radical left wing movement, and they want to bring in Hamas. They want Hamas to have a voice. This is according to Der Tagesspiegel. It says Israel haters are holding a conference in Berlin's Moabit district with hundreds of participants. According to the Domestic Intelligence Agency, the organizers have been linked to radical Islamic Palestinian groups like Hamas. Chancellor Merkel, she doesn't run the city. She runs the country, of course. But why these activities aren't banned, no one knows. Here's this pro-Hamas event taking place in Berlin, even as you're seeing all of these violent attacks against Jews in Germany. Listen to this. I think this is an Israeli station, I-24, but it's talking about the anti-Semitism in Germany and how that Jews, like we've seen across Europe, German Jews are fleeing to Israel. This is clip 9.
Rising anti-Semitism in Germany is driving Jews to leave the country. Among them are teens ages 14 to 16, making the journey alone. 15-year-old Golda is one of 25 youth from Germany moving to Israel this fall to attend high school as part of a special program by Israel's Ministry of Education and the Jewish Agency. Her mother, Evelyn, will stay behind for now.
Yeah.
I don't think that Jewish youths really have a future in Germany. It sounds bad, and I hope it will change. I'm not giving up hope that politicians would prevent a situation where we really have to flee. But currently, sadly, I feel like there really is no future here.
Both mother and daughter say they began concealing their Jewish identity in recent years, hiding necklaces with Jewish signs. They attribute this to the political rise of the far right and reports of Muslim anti-Semitism.
Here they are, German citizens, having to conceal their Jewish identity because of these far-right groups and because of radical Islamism, because of radical Islamists. The Jews don't have too many friends in this world, which is what makes what Donald Trump is saying and some of the positions he's taking just that much more remarkable. There were quite a few, by the way, funny moments in his speech on Saturday night as he talked about building the U.S. embassy, or the funding for switching from Tel Aviv over to Jerusalem. And here, we'll start with clip 11. This is what he had to say about, I think this is a discussion that he had with the U.S. ambassador over the new U.S. embassy. Clip 11.
I'm used to getting a piece of paper. But this is the way they do. So they bring in this gorgeous folder, twice the size of that. I said, what is this? Sir, this is for the embassy in Israel. I said, well, we just announced it, so what is it for? We're looking for land, but this is a commitment to spend $2 billion. I said, $2 billion? It's like a one-story building, right? Sir, we're looking for land. And we have some locations that we think are very good, but it's very expensive in Jerusalem, sir. But we have the right to go up to $2 billion, sir. And I had the first name, I had Donald signed. Then I heard it was $2 billion for the embassy, and I stopped signing it.
He stopped signing it because it was ridiculous. The funding that was supposedly set aside for that $2 billion, as expensive as it is in Jerusalem, that could buy quite a lot of property. And so he has this discussion with, the next one's actually where he is talking about a discussion he had with the U.S. ambassador, David Friedman, I think is his name. But here's the U.S. ambassador saying, look, now that the decision is made, we pretty much already have the property and the structure that we need to get this done. So here's the president explaining how that went down, clip 8.
He said, you know, you asked me to check on the embassy in Jerusalem. Well, we already own a site that's much better than any site that's ever going to be bought. It's bigger, better, has better views. It's best site in Jerusalem. And we can have setbacks, everything else. He said, I have more good news, sir. There's already a building on it. And we can take that building and renovate it. I said, no kidding. That sounds good to me. I love renovation, because if you're smart, renovation costs you much less. If you're stupid, it costs you much more. You ever hear these guys, oh, it's more expensive to renovate a building. How do you figure that? You have a frame. You have the walls on the exterior built. I mean, how does it cost you more? If you're stupid, it costs you more. But David's smart, so he calls me. So they were going to do $2 billion, right? So David calls. We have the biggest site, the best site. It's already there. It's a building. It's mostly not occupied. And, sir, we could redo it, I think, for $200,000.
And so he said there that he even upped it up to $500,000 of renovation, since they already had the property. They just needed someone with the courage to make the decision. And you remember all the commentators and probably the Hollywood types like Hugh Grant saying, if you do this, the world's going to explode. If you take this action, you will regret it. The sky will certainly fall. Well, the president has commented on numerous occasions that we made the decision. Nothing happened. The world continued right on the course that it's on. Now we know Jerusalem is going to explode in violence soon, and your Bible prophesies of that. But all the critics, they're a dime a dozen. They're all over the place, just criticizing every little move that's made. And he just continues to go forward with his agenda. Temporary resurgence. He's had some successes, to be sure. You think about just those three he rattled off in that previous clip. Recognizing the Golan Heights, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, and then ripping to shreds that disastrous Iran nuke deal. That's quite a lot of action taken in less than 3 years. When we come back, we'll go back to some of those early and significant dates in the PCG history. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
My father and John Amos, as most of you know, were fired from the Worldwide Church of God on December 7th, 1989. We just passed the 30-year anniversary of that date on Saturday. That same day, by the way, my sister, she was working for Joe DeCotch Jr. in the Hall of Administration in Pasadena, and she resigned on that day, December 7th. And on the 8th of December, the day after the four-hour meeting that my father and Mr. Amos had with Joe Jr. and Mike Fazell, the day after my father... He had a return flight back to Oklahoma City. My sister ended up taking that plane ticket. This is, I guess, back way before 9/11, when you could do that sort of thing without much of a fuss. She flew home with Mr. Amos, and then my father took her her little yellow pickup truck and proceeded on December 8th to drive across the country from Pasadena back to Oklahoma. And so December 9th, that's today, 30 years ago today. That was the first Sabbath for Mr. Amos, of course, was home by that point, as was my sister. December 8th, my friend and I from Big Sandy, we were both sophomores at the time, we drove my car from Big Sandy to Oklahoma City, or Edmond, that Friday before the Sabbath to spend some time with my mother, who was distraught over all that had happened, and to talk to my sister. I was able to go to the Amos household and to speak with Mr. Amos. He was exhausted from all that had happened. And so we had a quiet Sabbath there with my family. I actually had, a friend that went and was there with me through the weekend. And my father didn't get home until late Sunday afternoon. He had driven, as I say, across half the nation in my sister's pickup truck, and we were expecting him to be pretty much drained and emotional, exhausted from all that had happened, and yet he got out of that little truck and came bounding into the house. He was pretty excited. He had a lot of time to think, obviously, on 2.5 days of driving. But he knew that God was behind this. And of course, when you start to look at the fruits of what happened in the weeks that followed, for one, he worked along with Tim Thompson, the late Tim Thompson, and his wife, Melody Thompson at the time. They worked together with my father on drawing up documents that would incorporate the Philadelphia Church of God as an official state-recognized church. And if you know anything about the early church for the PCG, that first congregation to meet, not the Sabbath of the 9th of December, but the following Sabbath, December 16th, when my father was there, Mr. Amos, and so on, there were 12 people on December 16th, and then 4 days later, the church is incorporated as an entity recognized by the state of Oklahoma. Now, I had gone back to Big Sandy after I saw my father on the 10th of December. I had to get back for school, and I was at least planning to finish out the semester before returning home. But I remember in speaking with my father on the phone, and hearing him following that that action on December 20th, I remember thinking, wow, it's already incorporated as a church, and there's only 12 people? This is some ambitious thinking. And yet that's how he was thinking in December of 1989. I got home from Big Sandy on December 28th, so 3 weeks after my father was fired. And it was at that point, I think for the next, what would it have been? I guess it would have been the next 3 weeks or so that I attended the Philadelphia Church of God in the morning, and then I went to the Worldwide Church of God in the afternoon. I guess you could say I was straddling the fence. But that came to an end in the middle of January. And it was that at that point when we were hard at work trying to photocopy 1,000 copies of Malachi's message. We had collected a little over 900 addresses, mostly from the Oklahoma City area and Enid and the surrounding churches, and then some of the congregations in Ohio, the state of Ohio, which is where John Amos pastored before he came to assist my father in Oklahoma City. So 1,000 books, 1,000 manuscripts. And then, of course, with that first mailing, you can read about this in Raising the Ruins, my father, he wrote a personal letter to the brethren in Oklahoma City and Enid. And he said to these people, "So much has been distorted about what I said and did. I felt this letter was necessary." This was included with the manuscript that was Malachi's message. He said, "I feel it isn't asking too much of you to allow me to set the record straight." Mr. Arnold Clausen, he's the one that went to make the announcement that my father was disfellowshipped, he and Mr. Amos. It says, "When Mr. Clausen was sent here by Joe DeCotch Jr., Mr. Clausen had a meeting with the deacons and elders Friday night, the 8th of December. He related some statements that Mr. DeCotch Jr. said about me. Here's some of what I was supposed to have said in the December 7 meeting in Pasadena with Mr. DeCotch Jr. Number one, Gerald Fleury is supposed to have said he could run the work better than Mr. DeCotch does. Actually, I've never made such a statement in my life," my father said. Has any one of you ever heard me say anything like that? Number two, supposedly I told Mr. DeCotch Jr. to shut up and to listen to me. Shut up and listen. That's the way Joe Jr. remembered the exchange from December 7th. My father says, "The truth is I've never even told a deacon or local elder to shut up, much less one of my superiors. I didn't say anything even close to those statements." And then number three, also he said that when I send in magazine articles, I demand that they be printed because people must read what I have to say. And then my father went on to say, "The truth is, I haven't even submitted an article for possible publication in 6 or 7 years. He says further on in the letter, "Mr. John Amos knows those statements about me are not true. So does Jesus Christ." And then he makes this appeal. Would you please read the enclosed, finished message of Malachi? Then you can evaluate me by what I say, not what people think I said. He said, "The Oklahoma City and Enid churches went through terrible turmoil in the 1970s, more than most churches. I desperately wanted to avoid causing you any more problems, but trouble now," he said, "could be far less difficulty in the future. I hope that serving almost 5 years in this area has revealed my love for all of you." Further on, he said, "Remember the Bereans, how that they searched the scriptures daily to see if these things were so." He talked about how convicted he was of this truth. Mr. Amos, same thing. And then how much he really did love the people of that church area, Oklahoma City and Enid, Oklahoma. So that letter went out with 921 copies of Malachi's message. There were 13 of us. I was added to the mix by this point. 13 of us at the home of the late Tim Thompson, Thursday night, January the 11th, 1990. As we packaged those 921 copies of Malachi's message, and then the extra letter, the cover letter for all of the addresses going into Oklahoma. And we sent them off, and those manuscripts, That first copy of Malachi's message, it landed in mailboxes right around January the 16th, 1990. 4 years, just 4 years to the day of Herbert Armstrong's death in 1986. That's how the mustard seed got started. It started in the smallest of ways. A few people responded and then had those books, those manuscripts mailed to some of their friends, and the message spread. I'll just leave it to you to study Acts 5, verses 28 through 39, where Gamaliel is quoted there as saying, look, if this is, leave them alone, leave the apostles alone. If this is not of God, it's going to fail by itself. But if it is of God, you can't overthrow it, lest you be found to fight against the living God. Well, that's just a little bit more of that fascinating history from the early days of 1989 and, as I covered here today, 1990. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit feedback, you can write us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.